Hi, I'm Andrew.
And I'm Spencer.
And we're here at the Slowdown's New York headquarters. You're listening to Time Sensitive, a podcast where we profile curious and courageous people in business, the arts, and beyond who have a distinct perspective on time.
Andrew, this week you talked to Bjarke Ingels, who's an architect with projects happening all over the world and is among the most widely known practitioners today. What'd you guys talk about?
Well, you know, Bjarke is this amazing animated character. I was super excited to have him on. He's a friend. He's really inspiring. And our conversation went to a lot of different places. We talked about his childhood. We talked about growing up in Denmark and how crucial it was to leave for him to expand his sort of ideas and his practice. But the real reason I had him on is because he holds a really rare worldview today, which is that everyone can win. So he's looking for ways through his buildings to not only increase the quality of the people's lives inside of the buildings, but everyone surrounding it. His latest project was a waste-to-energy power plant in Copenhagen with an alpine ski slope on the roof. So he's an interesting guy, to say the least.
Great. I can't wait to hear it. Here's Andrew with Bjarke.
Welcome, Bjarke. People know you as an architect, a designer, storyteller, director of change. Today, I want to talk to you about a subject kind of dear to both of us, which is change.
Yes.
And I want to hear how you're thinking about architecture these days in relationship to time.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only constant in the universe is change. I believe Einstein has told us. I think since architecture is an incredibly old art form, you can say like whenever you have to design a school, someone has already designed some pretty amazing schools. So one way to go about it would be to go and find the coolest school that has ever been built and make one more of them. The only reason that's not, I mean, it would be a pretty good thing to do and it would improve on a lot of cases. But the only reason that it's not the full answer is that life is always changing. There's always a change in, you know, let's say if you're talking about schools, pedagogical insights, how to best activate and energize and stimulate the kids to pick up learning. So that because life is always changing, whenever change is happening, the world we have built, the framework we have created for life will no longer fit exactly because life has changed. So as an architect, if you can exercise your ability to listen and to look and to identify where change is happening and where change is coming from, you actually have the opportunity to accommodate that change, to give form to that future that is about to happen.
So you've often not just looked at the future or the present, but you also look at the past a fair amount in your practice. Can you give me a sort of basic idea of looking back into history, the history of architecture from sort of cave dwelling to now?
So there's a lot of reasons why if you want to gain confidence about the future, and if you're going to gain confidence about the future being different from the present, all you have to do is look back and see how different was the past from now. And if we start in a sort of a really large scale sort of a time scale, on one hand, you can say that as Darwin has told us, life has evolved by adapting to its surroundings. Life evolved as we believe at some sort of sulfuric vents at the deep sea, and then at some point life migrated up on land. And in the beginning, land was a very hostile environment because You had like radiation from the sun that you didn't really have under the ocean. So there was all kinds of like impacts. But eventually we found out to live there. And then, you know, life has migrated to new eco niches and has constantly adapted to those eco niches until the point where we invent tools and technology and architecture. Because now suddenly life, in this case man, gets the ability to manipulate our environment and to create new environments. So we're not only in the position where we have to climb a tree to get away from our predators, we can actually build our own tree. And now that it's no longer a found object like a tree, it's something we create. We have to start thinking, what kind of a tree would we like to climb? What kind of a tree would we like to inhabit? The same way, we don't have to just find a cave. We can actually build our own cave. And again, we have to ask ourselves, what kind of a cave would we like to inhabit? So you can say, almost like through evolution, we reach an inflection point where life that had been shaped by its environment over millions of years, suddenly life gains the power to shape our environment to life. So rather than life shaped by the environment, now life can shape the environment. And that's truly where our superpower comes into being, that we now actually have this capability of shaping life around us. And I think a great way to explain the power of architecture and the power of design is that the Danish word for design is formgivning, which literally means form giving, to give form to that which has not yet been given form. In other words, to give form to the future, and more specifically, to give form to the future that you would like to find yourself living in the future. So, and we've tried to look at those different evolutions of our environment through form giving over time scales, and we've looked at what we call the history and future of thinking, which is essentially the journey from the evolution of intelligence leading towards the genesis of artificial intelligence and collective intelligence, the history and future of sensing, which essentially is the journey from, you know, at some point, the Cambrian explosion, many believe was when the ability of sight was had evolved. And suddenly, all these different life forms that had been like roaming around in the dark, only being able to sniff and listen, suddenly when some of them started having the ability to see, suddenly, you know, predators that could see were like much better at eating up others. And prey that could see was much better at dodging predators. So suddenly, like, this new ability, sight, created this explosion. But of course, sensing is going to take us towards, you know, virtual reality and augmented reality, where we're going to blend virtual environments and physical environments into new sort of almost like multidimensional environments. We're looking at the history and future of making, which is essentially the journey from craft to robotic manufacturing and robotic construction, the history and future of moving, which is essentially this like journey of human migration, how humans probably evolved in East Africa and started migrating, and every time we went a little further, we had to invent new things, because like in East Africa we can walk around as God has created us. But as soon as you get to Scandinavia, you need a fur coat and you need a building. Otherwise, you're not going to survive that winter. So essentially, as soon as we started inventing new technologies, we could migrate beyond our natural habitat. We could navigate the oceans. And of course, eventually that history of migration is going to lead to a future of interplanetary migration that I think definitely within our lifetime, we're going to start migrating across a sea of space and get to other planets.
So form giving has this inherent kind of generosity to it. You're giving a gift of something. So I know that you've been exploring throughout your practice sort of dogmas that you can attach yourself to. Maybe it's your Danish heritage and Lars von Trier and the dogma film history. But rigorous dogma is important to you. You have a big firm. It's unwieldy. You have, you know, several different offices. You need to develop large initiatives to lead these big teams. Tell me a bit about this idea of generosity that's come out of this exploration and form giving.
Yeah, exactly. It came a little bit from the fact that, of course, like by now we're 550 people. I've always been very skeptic of trying to put things too much into a method, because I used to have this idea that if you write something down, it's already dead. But I'm also realizing that that there are. I'm also realizing that it's like the feedback that I'm giving, I often feel like a broken record, that a lot of what I'm saying is actually based on some kind of fundamental principles. And maybe one last thing, if you look at law, or if you look at like the Constitution, it's very rarely a list of things that you have to do. Because if you prescribe something, you're basically dictating what people have to do, and you are dictating the outcome. Whereas when you're saying you're free to do whatever you want, but you have to, you know, there are certain things you can't do because it'll inflict on the freedom of others, and there are certain sort of questions you have to ask, then you're not dictating the outcome, but you're imposing a certain rigor. And what we've come to...
And you're recognizing an inevitable change that occurs since you wrote the law.
Exactly. If you're dictating what people have to do, you won't be able to address the inevitable change that people are going to face.
How do you accommodate for time amidst change? I mean, Aristotle talks about time being the measure of change. And time's sort of our way of situating ourselves to that change. So how do you develop principles and dogma that can accommodate change?
Exactly. So I think what we've done now is that we've sort of decreed this kind of dogma that of only three things for now. Keep it simple. The first one is basically just to oblige everybody to identify the change that is happening or has happened recently within the field of their particular project. And it can be in the neighborhood where the project is. It can be in the code. It can be like the building code of that neighborhood. But it can be also be in the behavior of the program that's going to go into that that building. It can be in the technology that's used to build the building. So whatever, like to make a survey of change. And often you'll find things that, like, once you force yourself to not just start doing what you already know, but really to identify those changes, you'll be surprised to see how much change has actually just occurred in this particular field. So once you've identified the change, each project then has to address the consequences and the conflicts and the problems and the potentials that arise from this change.
And that gives you a kind of new purpose as an architect.
Exactly. You have this new situation. Nobody has really been here before, because now we are here, but 10 years ago we were not here.
It's a way of fighting kind of the anxiety of influence that all of you face in every field. It's sort of like, who am I to the rest of the field?
Yeah, exactly. Also, like, I know, like you mentioned Lars von Trier, we helped him on a project recently, and he basically said he stopped watching movies when he graduated from film school. Which means he has a terrible time casting, because he doesn't know any of the actors that are alive today. So he has to like rely on the kindness of others. But basically, because he's afraid of getting influenced, I think another way of dodging that cage of influence from others is to constantly remind yourself that the world has already changed since these last brilliant guys and girls did something. So that's the first dogma. The second dogma is, and I think it came probably from this notion of form giving. What do you form give? You form give a form gift. almost by language. So we thought, whenever we feel empowered as architects, because you can say an architect is a quite powerless profession because we have to rely on, you know, the financial power of clients, developers, people that actually have the resources to build a building. We have to rely on the...
You have to rely on a provocation first. Someone
has to be in the need of something and also have the resources to make it happen. And then they can call you, right? But then you also have to rely on the political power of... of the mayor of the city you're building in, of the city planning department and their regulations. So since we neither have the money nor the political power to make things happen, all we have is the power of interpretation. Then we can take all of the necessity that comes from the client and we can take all of the rules and regulations that comes from the city. There's also a climate we have to respond to and all these other things. And then we can sort of try to respond to that in a way that is not just answering all the questions we're being given, but also putting something in addition forward. And we call this a gift. So that the second dogma is that every project has to give a gift. And a gift is not philanthropy. It's just making sure that as we're solving this project, we are giving something back to the world that the world didn't ask us for. It can be provoked by the identification of the change. It can be that the change actually allows us to do something that would previously have been unimaginable or impossible, and we put forward that gift. And that gift, and you know, one really sort of clear example of this is the power plant we're opening in Copenhagen at the end of April, which is essentially the cleanest waste to energy power plant in the world. So the change is that where a power plant used to be polluting, it used to be something that was like noisy and dirty and you had to be as far away from it as possible. Now we can actually turn the roof of this power plant into an alpine ski park. You can hike, you can ski, you can climb the tallest climbing wall in the world. So suddenly what used to be the symbol of a problem, pollution, becomes this kind of celebration of a new kind of sort of urban landscape. Obviously, the gift is that we turn the man-made mountain that of the big building that the power plant is into an alpine park. And we plant the seed in everybody's heads that clean technology is not just better for the environment, it's better for everybody, because suddenly a power plant is not just some lost opportunity, a gray zone on the city map. It can be the most exciting place in the city, an alpine park in a city that doesn't have any mountains. So that gift becomes an exploration of the potential of that change. And it also becomes not just a gift for the citizens in Copenhagen that can go and hike and climb and ski there. It also becomes a gift to the future, that it becomes apparent that with clean technology, everything we know about power plants and waste management facilities is no longer really valid. It can be something completely different.
It elevates expectations.
Exactly.
From culture.
You can say like, my son is 4 months old today.
Darwin.
Darwin.
We should all hear why you named him Darwin.
No, I love the idea.
Slight segue.
Enter Darwin. So I like the idea that that you could name your son, you know, after someone that has been very meaningful to you. And I think Charles Darwin has, more than any other thinker, scientist, creative thinker, inspired me in how I look at the world and how I look at the world of architecture, even though his field was obviously a different one. And this idea that the simplest idea can be the interpretation that unlocks the most complex world. Because not only has Darwin's thinking unlocked how we look at the entire biosphere, everything that lives, and the complexity, the plethora of forms and ideas that inhabit the biosphere, But also his thinking turns out to transcend the biosphere both into the history, because it also explains a lot of how, you know, non-organic landscapes have formed. But it also explains how human societies evolved, how technologies evolved, leading deep, deep into the future. So that's one reason why I think Darwin deserved a... And, you know, I could call my son Charles, which would have been pretty brilliant, because he would have been Charles Ingalls, which is probably the nicest dad you've ever seen in the Little House on the Prairie, if anyone remembers so deep into our past. But somehow Charles also sounded like, you know, the Prince of Wales and other things. And then I looked up Darwin, because, you know, you never know. Also because English is my second language, I love looking things up, because I'm often surprised at what words actually
mean.
The
etymology, yeah.
So Darwin comes from Old English, which is much more similar to Danish, and it means dear friend. Dar is obviously dear, and ven comes from Danish. The word for friend is ven. So dear friend. And actually his mother's name is Ruth, which means friend or companion in Hebrew. So, you know, I find myself surrounded by friends. Well, any case, that was Darwin. Enter Darwin. He's now 4 months. He probably won't remember a thing until he's two. So he probably won't even be aware that there was a time when you couldn't ski on the roofs of the power plants in Copenhagen. So him and his entire generation is going to take it for granted. Ah, we're going to go to the power plant. That's where we climb and ski and hike. So for him and his generation, he's going to have a completely different baseline, and therefore he's going to have completely different demands and ideas for his future. So in that sense, when you give the gift of form, you actually reset the foundation for the generations to come.
And what's the third?
And then the third, that's just, so, you know, identify change, give a gift to the future. And then lastly, it's because, again, as an architect, you're always reacting or responding to these external demands. You're not really in the driver's seat. You're just trying to make the most of it. We were thinking as a way to insert a certain long-term trajectory in our practice and help form the future in a direction to start looking at it through this index of these six histories and futures. So I mentioned four of them, the history and future of thinking, sensing, making, and moving. And the last two ones that we haven't really done much with yet are basically feeding, which is essentially what brings energy to living beings. So it's agriculture, urban agriculture, etc., and to our environment. So what fuels our cities and our vehicles, etc. So energy, feeding, and finally healing, which is the history and future of human health, the human body, and will of course also go from not just reactive medicine, but into proactive medicine, longevity, and essentially also prosthetics, how we start not just healing what is broken, like fixing what is broken, but also stopping it from even breaking and even adding new abilities to our bodies. So I think by requesting that each project has to somehow insert itself into the future of one of these six fields, we ensure that we start maybe generating some new knowledge, start opening up some new doors, and start actually creating new avenues of exploration. Because I think one of the things that I find revitalizing about our practice is that once in a while I feel that we've exhausted possibilities, and I start feeling that, you know, something new must happen. And then, you know, we stumble upon one change, or we discover one sort of new idea that opens up a door, and suddenly through that door is like an incredible, like unexplored landscape of possibility that somehow can feed us for the next many many projects.
Well, so maybe this is also where architecture is really moving towards, more social, more political, more almost in a way that it's less about buildings and more about the world outside of the buildings.
Yeah, because I think in some way it's a good reminder that architecture is the medium. It's not the message. It's the container. It's not the content.
As a kid in Copenhagen, you took drawing pretty seriously, probably the first thing that you were recognized for and got feedback from. Ultimately, why did you not become an illustrator, a graphic novelist?
I think what happened was that I'd been drawing since, you know, kindergarten, and you know, I think like a little bit like this idea that if you're 6'7", then you're gonna be better at basketball than your friends, so you're gonna enjoy it a little bit more, and you're gonna be like exponentially better at it. I was somehow just better at drawing than the people in my class and the bigger classes. So I got a lot of positive feedback for it, and it became rooted in my identity. Like, kids would come to me and ask me to draw this and to draw that. And of course, I enjoyed, you know, it's almost like telling stories with those drawings. So it was certain to me that I was going to become a graphic novelist, like a cartoonist. But I had no idea how to go about it. There's no Disney in Copenhagen, and in France, you know, like European graphic novels, they come from Belgium and France, and I didn't speak French at the time. I looked and I found the Art Academy in Copenhagen, which is where the architecture school also is, and the kind of basic thinking was, I'd spent most of my life drawing things happening, so people, animals, vehicles in motion, doing stuff. I hadn't focused so much on the background. So I thought, spend a few years learning how to draw the background, the buildings, the landscapes, and then sort of go back into graphic novels. Of course, what happened was I fell in love with the background and I stayed in that environment. It also just shows you, you know, if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans. Like, I clearly had an idea and I clearly went elsewhere.
Growing up in Denmark, I mean, it's a different kind of culture. And I think that it has a lot to offer in terms of fearlessness and sort of tempering ambition in a way. Tell me a bit about growing up in Copenhagen and why the invention of the thermostat could only have come from Copenhagen.
Yeah, exactly. Denmark is a culture that is on many ways very successful in that it has a deeply rooted sense of equality. Everybody is born with the same opportunity. So education is free. There's a social security network. There's a free healthcare. You know, my parents are well educated, and I come from you know a very nice neighborhood on the beach north of Copenhagen, but I've only gone to public school, you know, to public hospitals and to public universities, so I essentially had the same opportunity as anyone, which is a great thing. But there's also a deeply rooted culture that just like we are all equal. There's a certain skepticism if anyone rises above the crowd, and I love the idea that the thermostat as a mechanism is essentially a mechanism that if the room gets too cold, it'll increase the temperature and heat it up, but if the room gets too hot, it will decrease the temperature and cool it down. So it'll basically make sure that everybody sort of the room stays at an even temperature. And that is essentially how Danish society operates, that it'll definitely lift you up if you fall, but it will also try to push you down if you rise above everybody else. So it has its pros and its cons. I think one of the things where Denmark can actually still be the cradle of innovation is that no one expects to become a billionaire. Because hardly anyone is. So, like, you pay 2/3 of your income in tax. So You have to really generate some excess value if you want to become a billionaire. So no one expects to become a billionaire, but no one is afraid of failing. And no one is miserable because they failed to become a billionaire because they didn't expect to become one anyway.
Taking fear out of the equation shifts everything.
Exactly. So when I had sort of graduated from the Art Academy, I went to work for my favorite architect, M. Koolhaas, for a year and a half. And then having sort of realized that dream, which was my wildest dream at the time, I was somehow left without any new goals, except maybe trying to do it on my own. And what better place to do that than going back to Copenhagen? Because I was certain that no matter how miserably we would fail, we wouldn't starve. There is literally a limit to how wrong things can go. Like, in fact, I used to have, because I mean, in the beginning, the first couple of years, it can be very hard to imagine that you're ever going to make it. And you work like insane hours and so many, you know, you submit all these competitions, you don't get any money for it. And of course, you lose a handful of them.
And you're not even a competitive person.
No, exactly. But you exactly. So you find yourself sort of doubting if it's really worth it. And then at some point, I just realized that I had been on a holiday in Koh Phi Phi in Thailand, where I took a diving instructor course. And there was like this Australian dude who had found himself in Koh Phi Phi. He met a local girl from the island. He had some kids, and he was instructing people in diving in the most beautiful coral reefs that I've ever seen. And I always like reminded myself that no matter how bad we would fail at what we were doing, I could always, you know, spend my last money on a plane ticket to Koh Phi Phi. Use my diving instructor license to become a diving instructor and basically live a life that for anyone, myself included, equals paradise.
But we wouldn't have any of the buildings you've made.
Exactly. But I was just thinking like, that's as bad as it can possibly go. And that's
so
pretty
bad.
Goddamn amazing. So if I'm doing what I'm doing, it's because I'm really excited about what I'm doing. Even if I feel like I'm suffering a little bit, I would actually rather do this than live in paradise.
Back to the idea of change, which seems to be the, in a way, the main theme of all of your life and work. What was it like to leave Copenhagen for the first time when you moved to Barcelona? What did you learn from that experience?
I think one of the amazing things about migration is and it was funny, like Hans Ulrik Obrist posted a quote recently. I don't remember who it was from, but he was writing, "Migration is older than language," which is totally true. Migration, which is essentially the change of habitat, is the source of almost all innovation in the world. And just like, again, if we zoom a lot back in time, it was the moment when the fish stranded on land that it started, you know, discovering all these like whole new capabilities. It was the moment when the monkey stepped out of the jungle and onto the savannah that it had to somehow rise on its back legs to look out over the far horizon. And in becoming better and better and balancing on the rear legs, it started like liberating the hands to manipulate stuff. So, you know, every time you migrate, new things evolve. One of the things as a person, I actually believe, because again, looking at my son, they say in the beginning, a baby doesn't really have a sense of self. And the sense of self actually is not a deeply personal thing. It's actually a deeply social thing. It's something that happens in the interaction with the mother, the father, the family, the environment. So, and you know, in hermeneutics, sadly, I know the Danish word, but in hermeneutics, you talk about which is the the philosophy of interpretation and understanding. In hermeneutics, you talk about you have a horizon of interpretation or a horizon of understanding. which is the world around you with which you understand yourself. But because you are immersed in your own horizon of understanding, you can't see it because it is the very background with which you see everything else. So that's why it's so easy to see things that are foreign and so hard to discover things that are everyday. When you move to another culture, like when I was 21, I moved to Barcelona to live there for 1 year. You immerse yourself in a completely different culture. Although still European, it's Mediterranean and Latin, not sort of a...
But you didn't know anybody.
I didn't know a soul. And I also ended up like meeting other people from other countries, you know, like a German, a Swiss, a Chilean, a woman from Corsica. And I discovered that these people were taking certain things for granted that I was like, oh, that's so weird. Or like, wow, I never thought about that. And they would be puzzled by things I would say that I would take for granted that would allow me to sort of understand, oh yeah, okay, I get it. I'm actually completely taking these aspects of life or society as if they were automatic, and they're totally not. They're an invention of Danish culture. And of course, what it also does, it allows you to adjust, because another aspect of this being so much a product of your environment is that your environment actually also keeps you captive, because your environment already knows your friends, your family, they already know who you are. So if you start being very un-Andrew-like, then suddenly they'll be saying, hey, Andrew, what are you doing? Like, sort of, that's so weird. So your environment has a tendency to keep you boxed in to the form that they already recognize as Andrew. But once you go to a new place, and I really discovered this because, you know, right before going to Barcelona, we had a theme party where I was living, which was film theme. And this was in 1996. I was madly in love with Trainspotting, Danny Boyle's, one of his early films. And I came as sick boy with white hair. So crew cut, white bleached hair. And of course, you can't unbleach your hair once it's bleached. So I came to Barcelona with completely bleached hair. And of course, attracted a completely different group of people because I looked radically different from what I normally did. And I just realized this sort of amazing thing that when you arrive to a new place, people will see you for who you are right now. And they'll hear what you say right now because they don't have, you know, decades of history to lock you in, not knowing, like knowing already who you are. They'll see who you are now. That actually allows you to become who you are now. And then when you move back a year later, you come back to where you came from as who you have become. Because that sort of one year break actually allows you to transcend your past and become your new you. So I've done it many times in my life. You know, then I migrated to Holland for like a year and a half. I migrated back to Denmark. Then I migrated to America. I spent the last year back in Barcelona. So every time you make these changes of habitat, you also open up a door for you to change.
You, in a way, I've heard you say that you sort of leap into a new you.
Exactly.
And I want to go quickly into your time at OMA. There's a great story about how you got the job, which people can find. But what I'm most interested in is what you learned when you were there, what you took away from the experience at OMA.
Yeah, I think they say be careful what you wish for because you might get it. You know, it is kind of daunting to meet your heroes because, I mean, I was so... you know, in love with the whole idea of OMA. And, you know, I read everything Rem Koolhaas ever said or wrote. And I had a pretty fixed idea about how it was. And I was also somehow expecting every person at OMA to be almost some kind of mythological creature. And I realized that they, you know, they came from all over the place and had all kinds of reasons for ending up here. And I remember like somebody had worked for Daniel Libeskind, someone had worked for Peter Eisenman. And I couldn't even sort of understand how could someone who was into that It was almost like I almost felt that they were like not pure enough, or like, right. I don't know, like some kind of obsessive idea.
They didn't spend enough time with El Croquis.
Yeah, exactly. So but then I realized that this was a very heterogeneous organism. It was not at all this kind of uniform movement. It was a much more complex organism that was somehow steered by incidental input from the chief curator, which would be Rem Koolhaas. And one of the things I noticed was the importance of production. That in architecture, I was probably much more cerebral at the time. And because the projects are so clear, I was certain that they had been thought, almost like thought in the head. And then once the thought was fully formed, then put into physical form. And I realized that it was the opposite. There was all this production going on, sometimes almost like aimless production of ideas and forms. Sometimes I was like frustrated at how, you know, like almost like mindless.
How iterative it was.
Yeah, exactly. Like, but it was like, but because it doesn't really matter where it comes from or why it has been proposed. What matters is why it's selected. Why do we choose to produce or pursue more of this and less of this? It's the moment of choice that gives direction, not the moment of creation. And later on, of course, I've brought it back to Darwin. In Darwinian evolution, each new individual, each child that is born, is the random mixture of maternal and paternal DNA combined with random mutation. So the moment of creation, and I mean this literally, is never aimed at anything. There is no direction, but it is through evolution, and in nature, it happens through selection pressures, which is basically that the individuals that are so successful at inhabiting the world that they live long enough to have offspring and to make sure that that offspring survives enough to have offspring themselves, those attributes are remembered and all the other attributes are forgotten. So that means again that it's the selection, it's the external pressures of the environment that gives direction.
And the thinking comes later. You know, you think about projects like Delirious New York, as you have the great fortune now of taking the wheel at shifting the skyline of New York sort of all over the place. And as we'll see over the next several years, do you think about Delirious New York? Do you think about sort of New York as a unique place to fearlessly process, to fearlessly move forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think Delirious New York was a brilliant invention, again, of Rem Koolhaas, trying to say that there was so much theory in Europe at the beginning of the 20th century. All these manifestos of surrealism and modernism and et cetera, international style, blah, blah, blah. But very little production, because inherently a manifesto is what you do before you have any evidence to back it up. And actually the brilliance of Henri Breton when he wrote the Surrealist Manifesto was that because there were no declared surrealists. So he starts pointing at you know, Picasso saying he's a surrealist, painter. He points at Edgar Allan Poe saying he's a surrealist writer. So he just starts labeling all these people that have nothing to do with surrealism and almost like drafting them for his army of surrealism. And essentially that's what Rem did with Delirious New York. He says there's this mountain of evidence with all these skyscrapers, but there's no formulated agenda.
There was
behind
no plan.
It. So exactly. So I'm going to retroactively write the manifesto that produced Manhattanism, which is a brilliant idea, and especially speaks to the power of the architect, as you can't really instigate the change, but you can interpret it and make it yours, right?
You could be the raconteur of the change.
Exactly. You don't have the power to push the wave, but you can surf it when it flows through. Maybe in somewhat similar way, like I think one of the huge projects we're doing here in in New York that's going to unfold over the next decade is the dry line, which is essentially the 10 miles of resilient waterfront that we're designing for Lower Manhattan, which is basically interpreting all of the necessary flood protection that's going to keep Manhattan dry, but to give it form so it becomes undulating hills, pavilions, giant pieces of furniture. So essentially, you have a much more lively, much more environmentally and socially active waterfront, but it's also going to be what protects the city from the next flood.
And is not an outlier. I mean, you've been grappling with these issues from the beginning of your firm, man and nature, how you democratize experience for the populace, how you protect from nature, how you engage with nature. Do you find that even though every project you're doing now looks so new, lacks a certain coherent style, you know, I don't think of your buildings in the way I think of signature kind of architects' buildings. Hopefully you can't pick out one of your buildings from its form, but more from its use.
Yeah, exactly. Like I would definitely take it as a compliment, because I would normally say that having a style is almost the sum of all your inhibitions. It's kind of a straitjacket that keeps you confined to who you were and inhibits you from who you could become.
You could have a functional style, an emotional style, but a visual style, we're past.
Yeah, exactly. I would say that I would like to remain rigorous in how I approach things, but I would rather be rigorous in the questions that I ask more than the answers that I come up with, because hopefully the answers should always be informed by new information.
People talk about vision all the time, less now, but it used to be like the hot word, vision. Now it's disruption, right? But vision is, what is it? You know, it's an aggregate of our responses. And in your case, an aggregate of your questioning. But as you move through all of these extraordinary projects that deal with nature in some way, it seems that your projects are becoming more and more long-term, more and more projective. I think that the Smithsonian's not going to be completed till you're in your mid-60s.
Exactly.
The dry line is years ahead. And then your work with Mars, I mean, it's deep in the future. Do you think about how... Well, I want to sort of tie it to one of your favorite writers, Philip Dick, and how he says that in science fiction, the plot's triggered by some form of innovation.
Yes.
So many of your projects now are in some state of waiting for innovation or are in a state of innovating, and they just simply take a long time. So how now in your career, which is quite young for an architect, you're 44.
Yes.
Which is a baby in architecture for what you've accomplished. Are you moving into a space now where the projection of time is so far ahead to accomplish the huge ambitions that you guys have?
Yeah, I think definitely when you start your practice, and I started like 20 years ago, 19 years ago, with my first company Plot, which somehow grew into where we are now, you're so impatient for evidence of what you're capable of doing, because there's always a huge discrepancy between the reality that you know you're capable of and the reality the world can see, because the reality the world can see is coming, you know, 5 or 10 years later. For instance, like this year we are opening 11 buildings, 3 museums, 3 skyscrapers, the power plant with the ski plant on the roof, a habitat for the pandas in Copenhagen Zoo. Projects, some of the projects have been 9 years underway. So that means that this year, 2019, the world can see finally what we somehow knew 9 years ago. So you're dying to catch up. I think at this point, we've reached some level of satiation, and we're starting to understand that exactly because something takes a long time, that is exactly why you have to start now. Because some of the biggest challenges we face right now, and like if you look at, you know, projections of climate change and, you know, the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, you're often talking about plans for 2030, which sounds like far into the future, but it's actually 2020 next year, right? 2050, which sounds really abstract. But, you know, human beings used to build cathedrals. Cathedrals, they take between 1 to 3 centuries to make. And back then, average life expectancy was closer to like 45 years. So 300 years, that was like many generations. And we still built the cathedrals. Like in Barcelona, they're still building the Sagrada Familia because it's only been underway for 100 years. So you know, just because it's going to take 100 years maybe to put a small city on Mars means that we actually have to start now, because otherwise we won't get there in 100 years. So all these huge projects that take long-term commitment are actually the most important projects we can engage with. And the fact that we might not see them realized in my lifetime is even more so a reason for getting them started now. And I think all we need to do is visit, you know, Duomo in Milan and marvel at this like incredible feat of engineering and art and architecture, and know that centuries and generations were put into this, and many of the people involved never saw it finalized, and the people that actually saw it finalized had no idea how it was initiated, but everybody still saw the importance of realizing it. And I think we have to look at our future on this planet and our future on other planets in a similar time scale.
Do you think that the hyper digitization of today, the onslaught of the sort of Silicon Valley explosion that happened the last 10 years, do you think that that is in some way informing your concerns with nature? Do you think that you're actually being pushed away from technology, or the way technology has been presented to us in the last 10 years, towards nature, and hoping that your buildings, your projects will help us engage more in human connection and less in a straight relationship to mediated experience?
I think it's quite interesting because, I mean, I do think that we are at the dawn of this new era where we are about to step back into physical space. Because I think a lot of invention, a lot of ingenuity, a lot of investment has been focused on the digital, the virtual, and the tiny in Silicon Valley the last 4 decades, I'd say. The first sort of global platform was the internet that connected all information. The second global platform was social media that took human relationships and connected them and made them subject to the power of algorithms. The third platform is when everything else gets connected and becomes self-aware. And somehow the digital and the physical world are somehow going to come back together again. I also think that I just looked at some statistics. If you look at, we just took an arbitrary marker, but maybe not so arbitrary, the launch of the iPhone, the first iPhone in 2007, and you see how the sense of loneliness just started spiking and has gone up ever since among 8th, 10th, and 12th graders. The decrease in sex, all of these sort of symptoms that being connected digitally is making us disconnected socially and physically. And I think there's a huge opportunity now to rediscover and reinvent the significance of meeting in physical space, the rediscovery of collective intimacy in physical space and the communal. So I think that's one thing. Another thing that I see is, if you look at the most exciting projects that have happened in Manhattan over the last decades, it's actually the Hudson River Park, the High Line, the Brooklyn Bridge Park, this kind of the Dry Line coming now on the east part. It's basically making the city more inhabitable for the citizens living there, and in some ways bringing nature back in. You have the Brooklyn Grange on a rooftop of a warehouse in Navy Yards, which is the largest roof farm in New York State. So I think nature agriculture, all of this is coming back into the city, like for many different reasons, but because the dichotomy between countryside and city is unproductive, and it makes more sense to have it around us. And then I think a last thing why, and this is something we're trying to actually imitate in the city, is that cities are so overcoded environments, because, and anyone who's, you know, you have three kids that have grown up, partially in New York City, you have to teach them that you have to walk on the sidewalk, you have to stop at the crosswalk, you have to wait for the green guy before you can go over, and if you hang out too long on a stoop, you're loitering, right? So a city is such an overcoded environment that you can only do what you're supposed to do. And, you know, if you're like a grown-up without a kid, you can't hang out on the playground because then you're a potential pedophile. Like, there's all these things you're not supposed to do. You're not supposed to walk on the grass. Whereas in nature, it's uncoded. So it's free for interpretation. That's why, so nature in some way is a grown-up's playground, because you can actually do whatever the fuck you want in nature. You can climb a rock, you can try to climb a tree, you can fall down, you can walk through the swamp, get wet feet. You can do all those things that you wouldn't really do, like if you're walking through a fountain, in the middle of the Lincoln Center, you'll probably be asked by the guards to get the fuck out of there. So in that sense, nature also has this freedom of codification that makes you rediscover just random experimentation and freedom of movement that you have somehow lost in the urban environment.
And so many of your projects are trying to reintegrate that and trying to bring that in, and which is why architecture might just save us.
Yeah, exactly. Like if, and I think that's the gift. One of the gifts that architecture can actually give us is opening up some places that are not yet fully coded, and where the human behavior is not yet fully dictated, and that it actually opens up the possibility of free behavior and of the of a human encounter.
Amazing. I think we'll wrap it there, unless there's anything.
I think you can cut it
because I did this once before.
Yeah, exactly.
Where I cut you short.
Yeah, exactly. Like the only thing, like I think there's maybe one sort of general thing, but it's not a fully formed thought.
I like that.
But it's also something you and I have talked about, because your medium is film, among others. If architecture is the medium of architecture is space, but what makes it life is when, you know, people start moving through space. And like sometimes I've had this sense, which is maybe meaningful or not, just like you can say length and height and depth, the X, Y, and Z axis, in a way, arbitrary measurements of that which we know is space. Maybe time combined with space is just an arbitrary measurement of movement. And maybe just like the only constant in life is change, the only thing we really have is movement. And time and space are just arbitrary markers or dimensions of that which we really have is movement. And both space and time become these ways for us to fathom this much more hard to grasp hyper object, which is movement. Because we're part of that movement, we have a hard time seeing it. But sometimes by focusing on either time or space, we can see aspects of it. But the one true thing that's really there is movement. And we're part of that movement.
Yeah, and I think what you're focused on is tracking that movement and trying to accommodate for that movement and make space for what's ahead that we move into.
Exactly.
Which is what I think makes your practice so special and your whole sort of potential for the next kind of 50 years that we'll have you adding to our world. Thanks very much for coming on.
A pleasure, man.
All right. Take care.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening. You can find more episodes of the Time Sensitive Podcast on our website, timesensitive.fm, or on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv.